Good morning, everyone. We are, as the bulletin indicated, we're going to finish up Lesson 6 today. Lesson 6 is titled The United Kingdom. And if you'll look up here, we put this up last week, but we've had some that were traveling on their back and that sort of thing, and I thought it would be good for us to start here. So here we are, right smack dab in the middle of the 17 periods, and this is just one person's way of cutting the Bible up into manageable pieces. So here we are, United Kingdom. And this is a period of time about 120 years, three kings, 40 years each. It makes the math pretty easy. Back up a bit. Judges was how long? Approximately? 400 years. Very good, Jack. And then the invasion and the conquest of Canaan, that really didn't take that long. It only took a few years, 6, 7 years, something like that. How long was the wandering in the wilderness? 40 years. How long was the Exodus? Okay, it depends on what you mean by that exactly. Yeah, they a year from Exodus to Sinai. And then you had the period of the patriarchs, the scattering people. And these first three or four periods, you know, they're long. They're hundreds of years. But again, so here we are, United Kingdom, 120 years, and then we're going to move quickly into the Divided Kingdom and close out the Old Testament, go into a period of silence, another 400 years, and then the New Testament, which is the last four lessons of the series. Appreciate it if you would turn to 1 Samuel, the 8th chapter. 1 Samuel 8. And then if you have your lesson book, page 22. On page 22, I suggest you do this. I know some of you make notes and are, you know, doing different things, even, you know, color coding some things. To make the lesson material more helpful. Again, I do feel that this is an exceptional resource material because you and I are not smart enough. We can't retain enough information to just automatically be able to perfectly categorize and organize the Bible. Some of us are better than others. I am the others. And so resource materials like this help. But on page 22, you notice it is called the United Kingdom. But now drop down about a third of the page. Draw a line. I would suggest you draw a line underneath 1 Kings 1 to 11 between that statement and the statement right below it. And the reason is I want you to emphasize on this page that above that line is the United Kingdom. Below that is the Divided Kingdom. And then if you drop down the page a little further to 2 Chronicles 1 through 9, 2 Chronicles 1 through 9, underneath that would be, I believe, a suitable place to draw another line, because just above that is the United Kingdom, and below that is the Divided Kingdom. And again, something we said last week, but I feel it's helpful to say it again for reinforcement, is these books don't always fall exactly in line. They're not exactly chronological. So if you look at those six books of history, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, they don't just go in order. 1 Chronicles backs way up and starts over. And so they don't start and they don't finish with the same exact events or people. So just to help us, I thought we would do a real quick level set there and draw those two lines. Now, with that in mind, turn one page to the next page, chart 4. Chart 4 on page 23, I've mentioned this a couple times already, I'll mention it one last time, is I believe this chart is invaluable. We will be referring to this chart over the next several lessons because it captures a lot of the helpful detail. And it's so easy at this point of our study to get lost in detail. The Bible is a book of detail, for sure. But we're not going to be following always one person, one character. We're going to be following maybe many at the same time. Or there'll be prophets alongside of kings. And not just this king, but the kings of the nations around Israel. So it can be somewhat confusing, and that's why I remind you of chart number 4. 1 Samuel 8. I want to start today's class now with reading two passages. These are bookends. The beginning and the end of the divided kingdom. 1 Samuel chapter 8. Read with me, please. And it came about when Samuel was old that he appointed his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of the first was Joel, and the name of the second Abijah, and they were judging in Beersheba. His sons, however, did not walk in the ways, but turned aside after dishonest gain and took bribes and perverted justice. So we have a problem. Continuing in verse 4, then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, behold, you have grown old. Your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations. But the thing was displeasing in the sight of Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed to the Lord. The Lord said to Samuel, verse 7, listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. Like all the deeds which they have done since the day that I brought them from Egypt, even to this day, in that they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now then, listen to their voice. However, you shall solemnly warn them and tell them of the procedure of the king who will reign over you. Now, I remember reading that passage, those first 9 verses, many times in my life. I think we need to finish the chapter because there's some invaluable information in this chapter about what the people are asking for. So let's continue beginning in verse 10. So Samuel spoke all the words of the Lord to the people who had asked him of him a king. He said, this will be the procedure of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and place them for himself in his chariots and among his horsemen, and they will run before his chariots. He will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and of fifties, and some to do his plowing and to reap his harvest and to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will also take your daughters for perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and your vineyards and your olive groves and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your seed of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants. He will also take your male servants and your female servants and your best young men and your donkeys and use them for his work. He will then take he will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his servants. You will cry out. Verse 18. You will cry out in that day because of your king, whom you have chosen. But the Lord will not answer you in that day. I want to read verse 18 again. Then you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves. But the Lord will not answer you in that day. Nevertheless, the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel. And they said, no, but there shall be a king over us. And we may also be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. Now, after Samuel had heard all the words of the people, he repeated them in the Lord's hearing. The Lord said to Samuel, listen to their voice and appoint them a king. So Samuel said to the men of Israel, go every man to his city. So here we have a request. It displeases the Lord, but God's answer is, okay. 1 Kings, please. The 12th chapter. (Clears throat) Let's read the 2 Chronicles passage again. Let's use it instead. 2 Chronicles 10, rather. Like I said a moment ago, these passages overlap a lot. We could use that as well. But let's look at 2 Chronicles. Actually, 9. 2 Chronicles 9. Folks, this is 120 years approximately later than Israel asking for a king. Saul has been king 40 years. David has been king 40 years. Solomon is being king, and he's toward the end of his reign 40 years. Now, I hope that you'll contrast what we're about to read with what we read a moment ago. Beginning in verse 22 of 2 Chronicles. So King Solomon became greater than all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom. And all the kings of earth were seeking the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. They brought every man his gifts, articles of silver and gold, garments, weapons, spices, horses, mules, so much year by year. Solomon had 4,000 stalls for horses and chariots and 12,000 horsemen. And he stationed them in the chariot, and he stationed them in the chariot cities and with the king in Jerusalem. He was the ruler over all the kings from the Euphrates, even to the land of the Philistines, and as far as the border of Egypt. The king made silver as common as stones in Jerusalem and made cedars as plentiful as sycamore trees that are in the lowland. And by the way, I think verse 27 is exaggeration. I believe the Bible does from time to time exaggerate to make a point. I don't believe that the streets of Jerusalem were actually running over with silver. But keep reading. And they were bringing horses for Solomon from Egypt and from all the countries. Now, the rest of the acts of Solomon from first to last, are they not written in the records of Nathan the prophet and so on? If we read the king's account, it would talk about his throne and how it was overlaid with ivory and gold. And just to look at the throne of Solomon would have been overwhelming, and because it was a magnificent throne. And read of the dedication of the temple when the tabernacle was finally brought into a completed building. And God's presence, pillar of the cloud, surrounds the building. And his presence is so strong, the priests couldn't even be in there because it was just too overwhelming. This is the pinnacle. This is when Israel is at its highest point. Well, maybe it is and maybe it isn't. Did the children get what they asked for? Yeah, they got what they asked for. Did they get what they asked for? Yeah, they got everything they asked for. And some things that they didn't ask for, but are automatically included. I find it interesting back in Samuel where we read how God very early reminded the people through Samuel of, and this is what it's going to work out to be. Now, jumping real quickly to the next lesson. What really prompts the transition from the period we're talking about today, the United Kingdom, to the divided kingdom? What really caused that change? Anyone? That's not meant as a trick question. Pardon me? I'm sorry, Joel. I still...
Solomon's apostasy.
Okay, and nothing wrong with that answer. That's not what I'm looking for. Read my brain, Joel. Read my brain. Okay.
I know what you're looking for, but I think the root cause is Solomon.
Solomon's leadership obviously had a major play into it.
God told him, I'm going to take the kingdom from.
Yes, he did. God told Solomon. God was very upfront about that. But what were the people doing exactly? You're right. That's all right. Kelly?
Rehoboam, who succeeded Solomon, refused to listen to the wisdom of the men who served. Father's regime and said, you'll speak kindly to the people and respect them, they'll serve you. And he listened unfortunately to the young arrogant men that were the people he grew up with, and they
another correct answer. And the reason I asked the question the way I did, and it is somewhat vague, I realize that, but the part of the root issue that caused a departure, if you will, from Solomon, not from Solomon, because Solomon's son actually was one of the first ruler of the at least half of the divided kingdom. I don't want to get into all that right now, but it's the very thing that God reminded the people through Samuel back in 1 Samuel. It overwhelms them. And the people are tired of having to support a king. Now, it is also coupled closely with Solomon's pride, his wisdom. He was very wise. He was also very proud because of what he did. That's obvious. It was coupled with the people's arrogance and people's problems as well. But I find it interesting that at the root of all that, it's because they were tired of what the king was all about. And he taxed them. He taxed them to the point they were tired of it. And as Kelly mentioned, they go to him and say, "Can you lighten up a little bit?" And he says, "You haven't seen anything yet." Actually, this isn't Solomon. This is his son Rehoboam. We'll talk more about that next week. But I find these underlying currents through these Bible stories to be of interest to me. Now, quick aside from me. In the early 80s, I decided it was time for me to be promoted. I came out of school, good grades, honors, got a nice job, nice pay. I married a beautiful, godly woman. I had the two children I wanted in the order that I wanted. Everything was just going perfect, right? And I decided it was time for me to have a promotion, so I started praying to God, "Promote me. I deserve it." I started talking it up with everybody at work. And so everybody knew that Rod wanted to leave Decatur and go somewhere else because that's what you had to do to be promoted. Yeah, and you know, I wanted to be the CEO of Amoco. That's not a joke. I wanted to be CEO of Amoco. And I expected to be the CEO. And after 5 years, if you haven't been promoted, you're losing space. You're losing time. You got to get on that track. Okay, well, guess what? I got promoted. And I moved my family to Joliet, Illinois. Hey, it's 30 miles away from where I grew up. This is going to be great. I get to go back and interact with people that I knew, extended family that I knew years ago. This is going to be fantastic. And I get promoted and I get to show my stuff. 6 months later, I was praying to God, "Get me out of here." That was one of my most challenging times of my life. And I think it has to do somewhat with my arrogance and my pride at the time, because I had the plan. So what I tend to do, I try to do, I don't always do this, is no matter what I'm praying for, I pray with the understanding that God's will be done. Even when I pray for my autistic grandson, I pray, "Your will be done." And guess what? The answer is no. Just as we studied a few weeks ago from Sean. Now, let's get back to the lesson. Don't ever conclude that you'd be better than the children of Israel. Please don't do that. You're not. I'm not. We would make the same mistakes they make. Probably, maybe not exactly. We would fall in the same lines. We would have the same pressures from the world around us, and so forth. Kelly? Horrific. Horrific choices. So that's a great segue. Kelly makes the point that, you know, just because you're a good father, and these men are, in many ways, commended by the Lord, but they also made some terrible mistakes. He used the term horrific, which is, I think, most applicable. And there were consequences. There were results of that. And even David specifically the Bible tells us about how what it caused in his family and the disruption and the conflict that later ensued. But now the segue is this. I want to talk about David for a minute. Because of these three, and I'm going to say even more than every other character in the Old Testament that we've talked about, even maybe Abraham, David is the one that is referenced the most in the New Testament. Abraham, I haven't counted the number of verses. It might be Abraham first and David second. But David clearly is referenced many, many times in the New Testament. His throne is part of the very substance of gospel lessons such as Acts 2. We're going to look at that in just a minute. It's the throne of David. It's the promise that God made to David. Now, we'll let God sort out the wonderful things that David did and the things that he did that were not so wonderful. Okay? So we don't have to worry about that. But we do know what the Bible said about David. I'm on page 24 now. And 24 gives us some detail. It tells us some, you know, what Saul did. And it didn't take us very long into the story of Saul to find out that Saul just had a problem following instructions. He just kind of did things his own way. But remember, God chose Saul. But God chose Saul because he looked like he was the type of person that the people would have wanted. So God essentially grants them their request, and he says, okay, and here's your guy, Saul. And so Saul is the king. Miserable king. Lots of emotional and mental issues, spiritual issues, of course. We know about the conflict between he and David. Even after David is first anointed at his home, that you're going to be, you're replacing Saul. And these two coexisted for a while. And that caused a lot of animosity and frustration to King Saul. Tried to kill David. All sorts of terrible things. David finally is on the throne. And we know the stories even before that of Goliath and other things. Okay, wonderful examples that wonderful stories that we teach our young people to emphasize a person like David and how God loved him and how he loved God. And in fact, at the bottom of page 24, there are some descriptions of him. He was a psalmist, and he was a man after God's own heart. Those verses are all through your material here. Even the book of Acts says that. He's a man after God's own heart. Wow, how could he be that? And he's an adulterer with Bathsheba, and he's a murderer with Uriah the Hittite. Because even though he sinned, he came to the resolution with the help of Nathan the prophet, but he came to the resolution, I have sinned. And once he fully appreciated and understood that, he accepted full blame. There was nobody else to throw it off on. And maybe that's what differentiates him from Saul, because Saul tried to blame the people. Saul tried to do this or do that. Those are details that we don't have to fully understand or appreciate why things worked out the way they did. But notice, and I'm two-thirds down the page on page 24, 2 Samuel 7. I want to look at 2 Samuel 7 for a few minutes. Because this is a monumental passage, because it is referred to over and over and over and over again throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament. Prophets talked about this, referred to this. The New Testament referred to this. Let's look at 2 Samuel verse 7, chapter 7 and verses 12 through 16. Now, we might read right over it. If we were just studying the book of Samuel, we might read right over this. Oh, okay, so God has kind of given David some insider information about what's going to happen. But again, when we take the Bible in its totality, we're able to understand what these passages refer to and how they have both a current physical meaning, that is David and his current throne and his current life, and something that's much more in the future, and that is Jesus. Look at 2 Samuel, the 7th chapter. When your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your descendant after you, who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish his throne, the throne of his kingdom forever. Who is that? Solomon? Jesus? Yes and yes. I believe it has application for both, a reference to both. Verse 14, and I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me when he commits it. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the soul of men. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. Your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever. Now, obviously, there is a statement in there that is in reference to Solomon and Solomon alone. Again, if we were just reading this, we would think totally Solomon and not so much Jesus. But now let's jump to the New Testament. Let's jump to Acts, the second chapter. And we're much more familiar with the New Testament passages, of course. In Acts 2, it should intrigue you. It should encourage you. It should comfort you, the fact that even Peter and the other apostles, because I believe the other apostles were preaching the same message. The Bible gives us Peter's account, but they were all preaching. But beginning in verse 29, now this is Peter, 1,000 years later, preaching to Jews at Pentecost in Jerusalem how they have crucified our Lord and Savior. Beginning verse 29. Brethren, I may confidently say to you regarding the patriarch David that he both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. And so, because he was a prophet and knew that God had sworn to him with an oath to seat one of his descendants on his throne, he looked ahead and spoke of the resurrection of Christ, that he was neither abandoned to Hades nor did his flesh suffer decay. This Jesus God raised up again, to whom we are all witnesses. So, we might have read right over the passage in 2 Samuel 7, but when you couple that with what some of the prophets said, and all those verses are on page 24, but it's never as clear as it is by Peter in Acts 2. He was talking about Jesus. When he made promises to David, he's making promises about Jesus, just like when he made promises to Abraham back in Genesis 12. He was talking about Jesus, but he didn't mention Jesus by name. And that doesn't matter. The promises were still the same in the beginning of the Bible and halfway through the Old Testament. They're still the same. Okay. I'll take a breath for a second here. Any comments? Does this all make sense? It doesn't matter. Yeah. That's right. Good point. Okay. On the bottom of page 24, you'll see that there are references to other prophets. We haven't really talked about the prophets yet in the Old Testament. They really come into play in the somewhat in the United Kingdom, but mostly in the divided kingdom and Judah alone, the next four periods, as is shown up here on the overhead. Okay? But they're there. And again, like Sean reminds us from time to time, and rightfully so, we take the Bible as a whole and we harmonize. We harmonize. That is, we make things. What's harmony? Harmony is when things sound together. They sound good together, right? Okay, we harmonize, we put them together, and we conclude correctly from all the information that we have. And there's so much that's said about David and the throne of David, which is not said about Solomon, and is not said about Saul, for sure. Okay, we have enough time now to look at page 25. Page 25. If you looked at the front of your Bible and you found a list of the books of the Bible, we would be, in this lesson, talking about the 6 books of history and then 5 books, well, four books of poetry. And if you're looking at that list, you're going to find there's some other books of history that are in between. Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. Those books are books of history, but they're going to fall in line a little bit later down the timeline here, right? So they're going to be down here in the captivity and return from captivity. But the way that the Bible is organized, that's the order they were put in. That shouldn't bother you. Shouldn't bother us. Does it bother you that the Genesis, the first chapter, talks about creation, and then Genesis 2 backs up and gives us some more detail about that creation? That's the way the book was written. That's the way Moses was instructed and guided by the Holy Spirit to write it. Okay, that's just the way it is. All right? Page 25. So we're not talking about Job, because we don't know where to place it exactly. All jokes aside, we don't know where to place it. But its structure, the way it's written, is Hebrew poetry. It's important that we understand Hebrew poetry is not like you and I read poems or write poems. When we write poems, what do we try to seek? What are we looking for when we write poetry? Rhyming. I mean, it doesn't matter what is said in the verse, that last word has got to remind with something before it or after, right? And that's how we make things sound correctly. That's rhyme. That's poetry. That's how we do it today. That has nothing to do with Old Testament Hebrew poetry. They are looking for thought. They're looking for the way that it moves from a thought standpoint. And we're not Hebrew scholars. You're not. I'm not. I'm taking the word of others that spend lots of time doing this. But that's why you'll find these books put together. But they do also somewhat fit this area. Again, we're in the United Kingdom. Look at these books. As Solomon is the exception on page 25. The other four are the four books of poetry that really relate to this period of time. You have Psalms. When you think of Psalms, who do you think of? You think of David, because he wrote the majority. He did not write all the Psalms. There are Psalms in there by Asaph. There are Psalms in there by Moses. There are all different types of Psalms. There are Psalms of praise. There are Psalms of beseeching the Lord for mercy and grace. There are Psalms that are precatory. Do you know what that word means? What's a precatory Psalm? Joel, you know what that means, don't you? What's a precatory Psalm? I'm sorry, I wasn't going to put you on the spot. His dad taught me the word, and that's why I thought that he would know. Precatory is a when you pray for God's judgment and justice and fairness and vengeance on somebody else. I've had members of the church say, we can't pray that anymore today. I'm still waiting for verses that show that. Yes, we should be ready to forgive others. We should be seeking their forgiveness. I also believe it is most appropriate to pray to God, I was wronged. God, will you take care of it? In your way, with your wisdom, in your time. Now, you have to couple it that way. Please don't misunderstand me and say, wow, Roger said we could ask for God just to go after everybody. That is not what I said. But if you have been truly wronged, injustice has occurred, I see the Bible teaching that it is appropriate to reach out to God with the proper attitude and say, God, please help. Please comfort me for sure, and please help me to have the right attitude towards those, my enemies. David prayed for his enemies, both that they would be defeated in battle, but he also prayed for their goodwill at the same time, or not the same time, but in other passages. The book of Psalms, we tend to think of it as 150 equal type songs. They're not. They're very, very different. There are songs, psalms of history. There are psalms that are meant to be sung as you're walking up the steps of the temple to worship. So the Psalms is a wonderful book. I don't know why. When I was a young man, my dad carried a New Testament. It was a red letter New Testament. We could talk about that another time too. It was New Testament and Psalms. I don't know why it had, that was the only book. Maybe it's because of what Jesus specifically in the latter part of the book of Luke referenced the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms. I don't know why, but some, or maybe it was just a big enough book, but small enough at the same time to put it in a little handheld. I don't know. But that was his Bible. That's one of the first Bibles I saw, was my dad's Bible, the New Testament and Psalms. Psalms is a wonderful book. It's a book that you should spend time with because it takes us into the innermost thinking of men who are grieving, who are joyous, who are experiencing all the emotions that you and I experience as Christians today. We're no different than Israelites. We're no different than King David. We have our ups and downs. We have frustrations, our challenges. We have our victories. We praise God. We do all sorts of things. These emotions are part of us. But God was always part of the picture. And that's the common message. And I think that's what differentiates him from others, or many others in the Old Testament. Proverbs. How would you describe the book of Proverbs? If someone stopped you on the street and said, "Hey, Jim," or "Hey, Maria," or somebody, they just stopped you, caught off guard. By the way, how would you describe the book of Proverbs? What would you say? And that wasn't just for Maria and Jim, it was for anybody. But what would you say? Someone other than Kelly, what would you say? Don't bail him out, Kelly. Don't bail him out. Britt?
It's one of my favorite books.
Well, that's a good answer.
The reason it's one of my favorite books is because it has really interesting sayings that tend to be truthful and insightful. And that's it. You can take 2 or 3 verses completely out of context and get a nugget of understanding or knowledge out of it, which is really different than a lot of the other things. There's not a lot of dependencies in there, but it's just little snippets, little pieces of things that can go on there. Whenever I think of the guys, the folks who wore the sayings on their heads in the ancient times, I think they had a whole book of Proverbs, cut those up and put them on their head.
Okay, so think of it, just like Britt described, and I'm sure Kelly's answer would have been right in line with that. It's a book that gives us some general principles in life. The challenge when we read a book like the book of Proverbs is we'll pull a book out and we'll say, we'll pull a verse out and we'll say, well, there it is, an absolute. I don't believe that's what the book is intended to teach. It is practical, common, everyday wisdom that oftentimes we forget, but we need to be reminded. But most of them do fit most of the time. But the problem I've seen in the past is when somebody takes a verse and they say, see, there it is. There's the absolute. Train up a child. Finish that. Train up a child. And when he's old, he will not depart from you. Well, okay. I'm sorry. You've got a multitude of examples of where that doesn't fit. And I believe it's because it wasn't intended to always. It's not an absolute. Was there a hand in the back somewhere? Just a second, Kelly. Was there a hand back there? Okay. Kelly.
I was going to say, it also contains unequal weights and a lying tongue over an abomination of the Lord. That's certainly an absolute.
Yes. In the first part of the book, there's some lists. 6 things the Lord hates. 7 are an abomination. Okay, those are, thank you for that clarification. Not everything in the book are generalizations, but you can differentiate those from later in the book when you start reading through, and this verse has nothing to do with the verse before it or the verse after it. And they're general principles that we should be aware of and we should learn from. But they're just general principles. The book of Ecclesiastes can be a book also can be misused and abused. It's a book that tells us what it's all about living here on the earth. And you know what it's about? It's about living your life quietly and godly, appreciating the blessings that you have, and living your life. Because it's a book about a man, Solomon, who tried everything else to get ahead, and to learn from this or learn from that. And he found that it's all, he called it all vanity and folly. That doesn't mean it's useless. It means in the overall scheme of things, it doesn't have the value of just being godly people. I have 1 minute left, I think, and that's the last book, The Song of Solomon. Joel referenced this book. This is the book about sex in the Bible. Oh, that's not the only passage, but this is a book where we read of a young man, a young woman, or the king and a young woman, however you tend to find that book about exactly. Two lovers and how they are interested in each other, and it is talking about physical attraction, bodies, body type. And so, I mean, he avoided the juiciest, and rightfully so, because it's difficult to teach something like that and not blush or not, you know, not get embarrassed. It's there, folks. It's been part of God's word for many, many years, for centuries. Okay, that's this period we would call United Kingdom. Things are going to change radically because of what was described earlier in this class, where Solomon's son Rehoboam, he wasn't guided well by his dad for sure, but things go real bad, so bad that this family that we've been calling children of Israel is no longer a family, and they split. And that's why it's called a divided kingdom. So we'll see lesson 7 next week, and appreciate your comments, and we'll go from there. Thank you.